Hey everyone, welcome to the 316th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have an awesome show for you today. We're going to be talking about Chip, Project Chip, huge news. Exactly. Long-awaited news. Wyze has a new device that, All right, smart windows coming out. We've got the end of life for a favorite IoT device. We've got a new thing from
literally
a streaming service. We've got a security vulnerability. We've got funding from a company I've long followed, and we're getting machine learning on Raspberry Pi 4s. Yay! That's machine learning at the edge for all of you who are counting how many times I get excited about this. Plus, Kevin's going to review the Logitech CircleView webcam. And we're going to hear from our sponsor, DigiCert, this week, talking about integrity and signing. Woohoo! Plus, we're going to hear from our guest, Sarah Spangolo, who is the CEO of Swarm. It is once again time for us to talk about IoT satellite coverage. I'm very excited about what they've got to offer. All right, let's kick this show off. But before we do, let's hear a message from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Qt. No, really, it's Qt. Expand the functionality of your IoT products and services with companion apps. Learn how to design mobile applications on one framework with no headaches, and join some seriously Qt conversations. This is an event that is going to be held by Qt. It is an IoT development shop, and it is a four-day free event starting May 18th through the 21st. It is called the Dev Des Days, and you can register at www.qt.io/devdesdays. And just so y'all are aware, Qt is spelled Q-T. So find out more information at www.qt.io/devdesdays. Okay, Kevin, let's just go right to it. The big news.
Good news and bad, I think.
All right, well, let's tell people what they missed. On Monday, Project Connected Home over IP, this is the group that is promulgating a unified standard for the smart home. It was started in December 2019 by Amazon, Apple, Google, and Samsung, so some big names there. And they all said, hey, nobody's buying into the smart home. I think interoperability is a big issue. Let's get together and build a standard. The standard is through Project Chip. And we waited all through 2020.
Yeah, this is what I call the bad news. Most of it is very good news.
Oh, okay. And we thought it was going to actually be out this January, and then that slipped. And now it's basically slipping to, we're going to say, late 2021. So almost 2 years after it was kind of formulated, they're going to actually start doing certification of these devices in late 2021. But they did tell us a little bit more about it. So we're going to talk about that. But Kevin, tell us your good news, bad news.
Well, the bad news is that it's the effort has moved slower than we originally anticipated, which we were told the dates, you know, when to expect the specification and when to expect potential devices. And it's like many things right now, it is getting moved back. So that's really the only bad news. I say we go over the news because then there's some still open questions that we could probably ask at the end.
Yes. So the news, this was a 10-person panel held by the Zigbee Alliance, and it was a lot. So what we know about Chip, we've already known that it was an application layer protocol, which means that this is about standardizing around data models and having devices taught, like a light bulb saying, I am a light bulb, I can do the following six things. That's the level of standardization. At the radio level, Chip will work over Wi-Fi, Thread, and Ethernet. That's today. It may expand further, but basically those are the radios.
No Bluetooth?
Bluetooth is sticking around as a way to provision devices, but we're not apparently running Chip over Bluetooth. I mean, is it a big blow to Bluetooth? No, because the radios are still going to be in there. I think you know, Bluetooth for provisioning makes sense because you provision usually these devices with your smartphone and the smartphone doesn't have Thread. So, yeah.
True. I'd actually like to get away from Bluetooth provisioning because it usually requires a separate app.
Yeah, that's one of the things we don't know. But first, let's continue with what we do know. Okay, we also know they added some more companies since earlier this year, like around February. They've gone to 180 member companies, including, and this is a little scooplet, y'all, Wyze. Wyze joined the Zigbee Alliance to become part of Project Chip. You'll learn more about that in the newsletter. We're going to talk about it there. Fun. Okay, they started hosting certification testing events in March, and those are going to run through September. So it's after September that we're going to start seeing products certified. But the companies that are doing the certification events now are the ones that are likely to be first.
Do we know what kinds of products yet?
And yes, we know some of the products. Here they are. The devices are going to be lighting devices, blinds, HVAC, TVs, access controls, safety and security products, access points, and then a class of smart home controllers and bridges. So there's a lot there.
We're going to need those bridges, I have a feeling.
Yeah. So the idea of the bridges is that this is, and this is how your Z-Wave and Zigbee existing devices will be supported. And I guess maybe your Bluetooth light bulbs. I mean, a lot of people do have Bluetooth light bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll end up buying a bridge that will speak to the Wi-Fi or the Thread network in your home and talk to those devices. Now, this is a little bit interesting. So when I talked to Wyze, they told me that cameras were not going to be supported. And that kind of shocked me because, you know, I was thinking they'd be under the safety, security, or access controls. Access controls is like door locks, so maybe not there. But I mean, not having your smart cameras work within the system kind of sucks because like then you're still stuck with, oh, well, if I want a video doorbell that works well with my Google display, I probably should get a Google doorbell, right?
Right.
So that's a little up in the air. I have a question out, but it has not been answered.
Well, these are the initial devices. It could be that they're...
Yeah, and there's working groups. Like, here's what I'm disappointed. Like, I feel like robot vacuum cleaners and appliances should be part of this, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel like wearables, I think, is interesting because that's how, like, I personally connect to my smart home. But it's also one of the things that's so closely to, like, tied to a mobile device ecosystem. And so, like, I can see how Apple or even Amazon that doesn't have a device might be kind of like, let's ignore that for now.
Well, it's interesting because this gets into one of the open questions. So I'll raise it now, but we can discuss it later. This worries me because you're right, wearables are very much part of an ecosystem silo to a degree, more so than other products. How much will Chip bring down the silo walls? That was my biggest hope for this. We don't yet know, I don't think.
No, we won't know until we can actually, like right now, the only way to see the entire spec is to join the Zigbee Alliance and pay to be part of the Project Connected Home over IP.
We could start a Kickstarter for it. That way we can get the...
Oh my gosh! Y'all would probably support that. I'm kind of like, oh, interesting.
Send us Dogecoin. Yes.
No. Okay.
Oh, no. Okay.
So more on this. So one of the things we also learned was that Chip is using the data models from .dot, which let's all travel back in time to 2016, 2017, when the Zigbee Alliance was like, oh, we have got to create these data models that are unified because way back in the day, Zigbee had like all these profiles and like some Zigbee devices didn't work with other Zigbee devices. It was a huge issue. So .dot was trying to bridge some of that confusion. And those data models that they built, those are actually the data models that Chip is built on. So if you're familiar with those, if .dot is not a mystery to you, you may know a little bit more about Chip than you think. And then a crazy thing happened on the call.
Uh-oh.
Asad Haque, who works with Comcast and is their member on the board, he was talking about security. And I'm really excited about this. Chip has a security standard built into it. So that's great. Because if you have a Chip certified device, you know you're going to get a couple elements on the security side. You're going to get AES 128-bit encryption between devices and between devices in the cloud. You're also going to get required over-the-air updates. Yay. And mm-hmm. there's a requirement that things are built with kind of a focus on security by design. These are not all the things you need to have a secure device, but they're really good. I mean, like, this is nice. And then there's the blockchain.
Of course there is.
So I felt like everybody's ears just go whoop the second Asad Haque mentioned, and we're going to have a blockchain. And I was like, what? They're not building tokens or offering tokens. What they're doing is creating a ledger or authenticating and understanding the provenance of a device. So it's going to have like a product ID, a vendor ID, and then you can also go there to look and see like the string of software updates that it's had. So you basically understand that this is a legit device that's on the network and who it's from and when it was last updated and all of this good stuff.
So it's I guess I would say decentralized industry book of record for those types of data points on the devices.
Yes, exactly. So there will be, you know, they'll have to have consensus and things like that, but this isn't like a mining issue. This is more of a...
Right, yeah.
So the way I look at this is it is a scalable programmatic way to establish authenticity and security of devices. And I guess integrity, you'll hear more about that in the ad, actually. But what's going to happen and why this matters is if you have all of these devices in your home, like maybe you have like 100 of them, you're not going to want to track that manually. You're not going to want to be like, God, did I update my light switch in my bedroom? I think there was a vulnerability there. You're just going to want to have a service or something that does that for you. And this enables that. So it's forward thinking, but it's good forward thinking.
It's very good. It's what the industry needs. I wish there was one more piece to it, though.
Hit me.
I wish that somewhere you could verify how your data is being used per device and vendor, a centralized or decentralized place to look for that.
Ooh, I'm sure they don't want to share that.
I'm sure they don't.
Okay. So let's talk about some questions that we have or some more questions. So people asked, but there was a definite punt on, hey, how are Apple, Google, and Amazon going to implement chip in their device systems, right? Like, hey, can I easily switch between Google and Amazon in my house? Or Kevin, you had a great question. Can I just automatically rip and replace, go from one to the other?
My thought is, and maybe this is too optimistic, is that device makers won't have to build multiple SKUs or products for the different ecosystems. It's just if somebody builds cameras, it can be one camera. You can use it with HomeKit. You can use it with Google. You can use it with Apple, whoever else is part of chip. So you're not tied to the ecosystem if you switch. Well, I should say you're not tied to the device if you switch ecosystems. You know, you're just not stuck in that rut of having the same, being limited, I guess I would say.
Well, maybe not for cameras because we're a little.
Well, there's that. Yeah.
Plus, that's everybody's subscription revenue. Money. Okay. The other thing, I don't know about the app situation. Like, and this is a big deal. Like, I know that when we'll talk about this later with your Logitech review, things like HomeKit, you know, you don't have to have an app. You just add the thing. Unclear on this side if we'll have similar provisioning, right? And we'll similar need to not have an app. And then Amazon was missing. This was a panel with 10 people. And I feel like additional people showed up to answer questions too. And, you know, someone from Google, SmartThings, Apple. I mean, Apple was there. Apple's never at these things. We had chip vendors, we had Tuya, but we didn't have Amazon. And I thought that was a weird...
That's concerning to me, quite honestly, because Amazon, more so than Apple now, to me, really wants to own the relationships with the customers, own the data, own the ecosystem, and keep it locked in a sense. You know, look at Amazon Sidewalk versus the general LoRaWAN. Look at all the devices that work with Madam A, and that's it. You know, even wearables, you know, I don't like that.
Yeah, and they don't have a mobile play, and everyone else kind of, well, everyone else, the other three big players do. And they have the Madam A dev kit, right? So they have a board that just automatically drops Madam A on something. This isn't something that's easy to chipify, I don't think. Oh, speaking of backwards compatibility, because that is something. So for backwards compatibility with your stuff, if something has a Zigbee radio, because they're the same underlying radio protocols for Thread, you could get backwards compatibility if the manufacturer chooses to update it and has enough memory to push that update, right? This is designed, the low bandwidth stuff will be Thread, the high bandwidth stuff will be Wi-Fi. So some of your devices will likely get updates, the newer ones, and some of the manufacturers may put out bridges that will bring you into the chip ecosystem. So I look for, like, it's an open question if something like Philips Hue will need a bridge, but that's a good, like, the light bulbs will still be fine. You'll just replace your bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And those are still understandably open questions. I mean, if they're just going through certification processes now, I get it. But I think that's what most people are worried about when all this happens, assuming that the whole industry or most of it adopts this, people are going to be like, well, what do I have to replace now? And hopefully it's very little.
Yeah, you may have to do a wholesale controller upgrade for like your Zigbee and Z-Wave devices, which means you'll have to like re-include them in the network. And that might be kind of... yeah, might be a PT pain. Like someone asked about Home Assistant on the panel and they were like, well, Home Assistant developers are here. And for things like that, what'll happen is Home Assistant developers will probably create a driver and you'll buy a physical product that bridges like Zigbee to Thread or, you know, whatever. So I think we will see like Home Assistant type support for that. So, Okay, big picture take here. I am excited. This is delayed longer than we would all like. We still have a lot of questions about how open this will truly make things, but I do think it's a good step forward, especially for kind of lower commodity devices, because I really don't want to have to think about an app for my lock or my open-close sensors. So, there we go. Hey, let's go back to Wyze.
Because it wouldn't be a week without another new Wyze product being announced.
Good Lord, yes. So yeah, I've been talking. You tell us about the new Wyze product.
Okay, you can pre-order now the new Wyze floor lamp. They call it a floor lamp. It's very much a task lamp because it has a very focused or limited range of light. It only lights up. It's got like a 30 degree.
It's a narrow beam, y'all.
Narrow beam. A task light, but it's a floor lamp. It is $30 plus shipping. I'm sorry, it's 23 degrees. Oh my. Very high color rendering index LEDs, 90 plus CRI, which is good. And it is 4,000 Kelvin for the light temperature. So a cool white is what they're saying. Yeah, it's pretty tall, 5'11". It's taller than me, although most things are. And I don't know what else to say about it. You actually connect it to your Wyze app using Bluetooth.
And then you can control, dimming,
schedules, sleep. Dimming, delays, sleep modes. Yeah, the typical smart light fixture type of things.
I'm going to say that looking at this lamp, the on-off switch is in such a weird spot. It makes total sense. This is like, you're never going to manually deal with this, I think.
No, it's down. It's in the wire. It's down by the base.
Yeah.
Which is pretty common for pretty common in floor lamps.
Yeah, but usually it's all the way on the ground. So you just open it. That's me stomping on my lamp with my foot. I mean, it's a finger button, but it's where your foot is.
The electrical wire doesn't go into the round circular base. It goes like into the stem of the floor lamp, but looks like maybe a foot in the air, which I don't understand that at all. But yeah, I don't need a floor lamp. I'm going to pass on this one personally.
Wait, there's a puck.
That is a Bluetooth button.
Oh, okay.
So you can put that on the floor and stomp away if you like.
Okay. So the puck is actually how you turn it on and off.
It's a way.
Or a way. You could do it. Oh, you could stick it on the wall. Anyway, the point is, I mean, if you need a floor lamp, this is fine. To me, it's just a weird, it's a little weird.
It's a very niche-y kind of floor lamp because it is really a task lamp, maybe a good reading lamp, 800 lumens.
You cannot use it as a grow light. That is in their FAQs, in case you wonder.
Really? People are asking that.
I guess. Why is this from all Seattle? Right. We're all very focused on that here. And it is not going to support any integrations at this moment. So no Matome, no Google, no Ift, no HomeKit.
Yeah.
Boom. Just Wyze. Okay. So if you're into that and it only comes in black, Shades of Henry Ford. Okay. Mm-hmm. Moving on to a different source of light, your windows. I don't know.
Well, that was a good try at a segue.
Wasn't it?
Yes. This is more light blocking. Light blocking.
Well, they let the light in and then you let them dim. Okay. This is very cool technology. I want it. I'm not going to replace my
windows.
We saw
this technology, actually. Two or three CESs ago, Halio was showing off their smart dimming windows, essentially. They have electrochromic glass, and they get connected to some type of controller, and you can either automatically or manually basically dim the light coming through your windows by having these things tint. And it took at least a minute when we tested it out on display at CES 2 or 3 years ago, maybe faster now. But the big news here really isn't the product, because the product has been around. It's that Marvin, which is a large manufacturer of windows, doors, etc., they are partnering with Halio to start offering these tintable smart windows in their product line.
Yes, they're launching a skylight, which I think is really important, because I once had a skylight in Seattle and it was in my bedroom. And that was a dumb place to put it, because the sun rises at 4:30 in the morning in the summer, and you just don't need that much light.
I don't.
So it's it'll be a dimming skylight, yay. And then a immersive glass alcove, which I'm thinking like a shower, maybe?
No, what it is, if you have like bay windows, it's kind of like that. It's like a rectangular frame of glass. And you put it, like maybe you could put a bench underneath it. It kind of juts out from the house.
Got it. Okay, that helps.
20 square feet. It's basically a small extension. You take all your windows out and kind of create this modern bay window that has tinting windows.
Ooh, I want that. Ironically,
I'm sure it's not cheap.
Windows are not cheap. I know this because in September, I bought a bunch of Marvin windows for my home renovations. So this is pretty cool technology. The only other thing I'd point out here is it's interesting because we're starting to see building supply companies integrate smart home tech into their products. And I'll tie it back to Masonite, which a couple weeks ago announced a deal with Ring and, Yale Locks to have an integrated smart door, so a powered smart door. And these windows will need power. So I think this is a really interesting trend. I think it'll be, we're about to hit a renovation boom, I think, with people having some money, some people having money after the pandemic, the type of people who are going to be buying this stuff, being interested in having people in their homes and renovating them again.
So. Even us early adopters that may have like what we consider a fully kitted out smart home now, these are new opportunities for new products for us.
Yeah.
Like how many more cameras and things can I buy, right? But now smart windows and true smart doors, well, that's different.
Yeah. I'm really regretting my decision to renovate last year. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I bought the house. All right. Let's talk about some sad news. The Harmony remotes. They are leaving. So Logitech announced Harmony. Man, I was still at GigaOm. I remember Mark Spates.
More than 10 years ago.
Yeah, he was over at Google or Mark Spates is at Google, but before that, he was at Harmony. And I first met him when they were launching the Harmony line of remotes. And this was like, the idea was you would have something that tied into a variety of smart TVs, a variety of speakers, your lights. It was really nice.
It was a slick product. I mean, very programmable displays on some of them. I mean, they weren't cheap, but they served a good purpose.
Yeah, and they bridged your smart, I guess, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth products to your IR products, like your television. Like, I used mine to set up a movie night because I had, like, this crazy sound setup and a receiver and all this. And, like, nobody knew how to, like, what order to turn things on. And so I just programmed it and it was done. But they're gone. So Harmony's supporting it. They're not going to sell anything more. And then eventually, once the current stock sells out, they're just not going to make any more. And then they'll support devices and update the platform. But
it's a goner.
It's a goner. So, okay.
Mm-hmm. Now the most controversial product of the week.
Ta-da! This is the Spotify car thing. This is not a real product that you can buy. You have to go to Spotify, sign up, and pay for shipping, but they'll send you a free car thing. This is a device for, it's a dedicated Bluetooth-controlled device for your car, lets you control Spotify. It's got a little screen, it's got a big knob, and the idea is if your car doesn't have Bluetooth capability, I actually, up until 2015, I didn't have a car with Bluetooth in it. So it's still a thing that people don't have that.
You can plug it into a USB outlet if you happen to have that, Bluetooth, even an aux port. The funny thing is, it also works with Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, which I find hilarious because those have displays already and no knob, maybe, but...
Yeah, no knob and, you know, I don't know. So...
Yeah. Just to be clear, this is to get the music, the Spotify music from your phone to your car.
Yes.
This is not a standalone Spotify player.
So apparently Spotify thinks they're solving a problem. Kevin thinks this is just silly. I think it's interesting, not because I would want it. Like the picture that they're showing from The Verge, which wrote about this, is hilarious to me because it's got someone's smartphone on a dedicated car holder thing. And then it's got this other thing attached to like the air vent in its own little holder. And, you know, it takes voice.
Yes. You can say, hey, Spotify. And it does solve a problem in that there are more physical controls to mess around with Spotify. And that's good because if you don't want to use voice, can't use voice, whatever, and you want to change things on Spotify, you are going to be looking for a touch screen on your phone to do things, or even a touch screen on here, I guess. But it solves a problem. But is it a really huge problem? I don't know.
So I think this solves an interesting problem, which is how, as the maker of a connected service, right, how do you get people to value you? And like, I value Spotify because it's just everywhere. It's omnipresent in my life. Because I've tied it to all my smart speakers inside my car, all this stuff. But for people who haven't, or maybe don't want to do that, how do you make sure people are able to easily listen to your service or use your service? And I think of this, like, if you're going to make hardware, and a lot of people make hardware just to remind them what they're paying for, like a physical thing you can touch that ties to your $5 or $15 Spotify subscription. But think about something like Peloton, where you have a device that's tied to a service. It's just the device. Now that Peloton has the app, they went about it backwards, right? They built a device in the service, and then they're branching out to serve other people.
In fact, my wife takes advantage of that because we bought a much less expensive exercise bike, which she subscribes to Peloton Digital for the classes.
There you go. I just think it's an interesting kind of, what does a physical device that's tied to a connected service need to offer to make it worth the money? Obviously, in the Spotify case, you think it's silly.
You said that this helps. It helps Spotify. Does it help? It probably helps Spotify more than it helps me, is where I guess my beef is.
That's fair. But, you know, if you didn't have Bluetooth in your car, maybe it would help you more. I don't know.
No, you're right. I mean, there are cars. People have cars that don't have Bluetooth, or, you know, they've got an aux port, no USB. I get that. I do. And that's fine. I just don't think this is all that. I don't see a long shelf life here for this.
Okay. And that's fair. I wish they'd do something more like Mighty. You know, I remember that. I still love my Mighty, actually. It's a tiny little, what is it?
Look like a little MP3 player, essentially. Yeah, real small that you hook on your belt or whatever.
Yeah, it's super small. It's got Bluetooth, or I had wired headphones, so whichever. But it was perfect for not bringing my phone out when I went running, which it's big and clunky, right? When you're running, you don't necessarily need that.
You would move your Spotify music to this. And that was it. Well, and I agree with that. That's why me and a gazillion other people are waiting for offline Spotify playback on Apple Watches and other devices. There are very, very few wearables that truly support offline Spotify.
All right. Spotify, if you want a thing, go buy Mighty. Okay. Let's move on to today's vulnerability of the week. Today's vulnerability of the week is name rec. Yay. This is a class of vulnerabilities that affects the TCP/IP stack. We actually saw this vulnerability. We saw a similar vulnerability with the Ripple 20 vulnerabilities that affected a piece of software. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. Well, at least it's not Telnet. That's one thing we can say. And specifically, the operating systems that are most vulnerable are very IoT, not all, but very IoT related. FreeBSD, which is, I'd say, general purpose, IPNet, Nucleus.net stood out, and NetX. NucleusNet, you're probably more familiar with, I have a feeling, because it's more, I believe, like an industrial and machine-y kind of space.
Yes. I like your industrial machine-y kind of space. It's one of many. So, yes. Yeah. All right. Moving right along. Let's talk about funding. Density. This is a company that makes people tracking devices for commercial spaces. They added $25 million in additional funding. They have been going like gangbusters. We had the CEO, Andrew Farah, on the show early on, actually, in the pandemic, talking about people using it for people counting. And they also brought the former head of CBRE's commercial real estate group on as an employee, which is great because that is their customer base and they own a lot of property. So what I like about Density is they don't use cameras. So they're tracking people in a privacy-aware way, and I appreciate that. So, like it. All right. The final bit of news is Edge Impulse. This is a machine learning company. They are offering official support for the Raspberry Pi 4. This is an industrial Raspberry Pi. So now what you're going to be able to do is...
for very little money, create some ML models.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, it's actually kind of neat. We tried to do some of this with our own code in class about 2 years ago, and it was very challenging. And as I look at some of the projects and results of the training models using the Edge Impulse and the Raspberry Pi 4, it looks like it makes it very easy. Like you can train something, a camera, for example, to detect what type of bird is sitting out your window with a certain percentage of certainty. Just one example.
Very common example.
Well, I don't know. You've also got like optical character recognition for signage and things like that. So, you know, I just think it's neat because it's anybody could get into this. And I think it would be smart for people, younger people especially, to get into AI, ML, and object detection because we're very early on and you don't need to spend a lot of money to start learning this stuff.
Exactly. All right. Man, we are just talking up a storm. Okay, let's talk about the Logitech Circle View webcam. Were you as excited about this device as you were about the doorbell?
I was as excited because it uses similar optical technology. It's also cheaper. The doorbell's $199 and this HomeKit compatible security camera's $159. I will say, overall, I very much like it. There are key things missing from it compared to the video doorbell in terms of the optics. There's no HDR, which is really, really good on the doorbell. So if somebody, especially in the afternoon at my house, the doorbell faces the sun and they just get blown out with other doorbells. But with HDR, it compensates for that. The other thing is no color night vision. It's just regular night vision. Small nits, to be honest, but that's just my thought. As I said, it's HomeKit compatible. If you've used HomeKit and added devices, it's no different. It's super simple. You scan the QR code that comes on the product with your home app, and literally it just does everything, sets it up on your Wi-Fi network. Interestingly, this is a 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi radio inside, just like the doorbell.
Huh.
But I didn't have any problems this time connecting it to my home network on the Eero 6 Pro, whereas before with the doorbell, I had to turn off the 5 gigahertz radio temporarily.
Okay. Well, maybe Eero has learned. Maybe Logitech has learned.
I don't know. As I said, no app to download. It's just use the home app. This also supports HomeKit secure video, which was one of the key selling points, in my opinion, of the doorbell. So that's good. Just keep in mind, well, let me explain what that is for people who don't know. That is Apple's end-to-end encrypted secure video storage service. So if you want to save recordings and make sure nobody else can see them, you could use HomeKit secure video for that. However, it does require an iCloud subscription, a data subscription of at least 200 gigabytes, which is what I put my family on for the testing of the doorbell. When I went to add this camera to it, it said I had to upgrade to the 1 or 2 terabyte plan, which is like $10 a month instead of the 3 that I'm paying, because it's one camera for the lowest iCloud. It's up to 5 cameras for the next tier. So I just turned off recording from the doorbell and just use my same account with us. So just a test. And it works really, really well. I'm amazed at the image quality and the field of view. They say 180 degrees. I haven't measured it to the degree, but I would say, yeah, it's about 180 degrees. It's ridiculously wide.
It is.
Unbelievably wide.
Although horribly unflattering if you're standing in it.
Yes, as I was. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Those fisheye lenses, they don't do anything for your
I agree.
Confidence.
At the edges, things start really getting distorted. Now, this is indoor or outdoor use. It's waterproof. The cord is built in. It's 10 feet long and USB on the end. So you could put it outside, but the power brick is not waterproof. So you either have to have a waterproofed outlet that you can hide the power brick, or you need to route this wire inside somewhere. And it's a shame because outdoor, I think this thing really shines because the wide view. Instead of using three or four cameras to get the whole house, every corner, you could probably get away with one less, maybe two less. I don't know. It depends on your house. But with that wide view, you can use fewer cameras. And the speaker on this for two-way communication is the loudest I've heard on a connected webcam. Super, super loud when speaking from my iPhone to whoever's standing in front of the camera. I could also do that with my Apple Watch. Not nearly as good, not nearly as loud, but it is doable. So you've got your typical automations that the Apple Home app supports. And I say that specifically because there are some options I'd like to see, but it's not really up to Logitech. It's up to Apple in that case. So notifications work fine. Yeah, it's really good. And now it's also more of a higher tiered camera than I typically use. I typically use the Wyze cameras. And there's no comparison between a $20 and $160 camera. So I'd like to get my hands on some of the other products in this space to really compare them. But overall, I like it.
Got it. Okay. And I just want to confirm to everybody, we were kind of doubting. Were we doubting? I don't know. Cameras are not supported with chip. I'm just going to say that. Since we're talking about cameras, we started with chip, we'll end with chip. Actually, we're going to end with our voicemail. So it is time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline. This is where we take our questions from y'all and also enter people in to win a smart speaker of their choice. And the podcast hotline is sponsored by Very. Very is a fully distributed IoT engineering firm. It will help you get your projects fully operational on time and on budget. You should go discover what Very's multidisciplinary teams can do for you at www.verypossible.com. You can reach us with your questions at 512-623-7424. And now, let's hear this week's call from Alan.
Hi, my name is Alan Willick. Here's my question. I've heard many of your episodes, and you've talked about wireless technologies like Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and how they play into Thread and chip going forward. But I'm pretty heavily invested in SmartThings, and so Zigbee and Z-Wave, or Z-Wave, as you call it in the U.S., I'm from Toronto. Those are wireless technologies that I'm very familiar with and I've been using now for years. But I don't hear you talk about the future of them very much. So I'm very curious to know what you believe is the future of Zigbee and Z-Wave going forward, with or without Thread and chip in terms of the network topologies. Look forward to hearing your answer. Thank you.
Okay, Alan.
This is rather timely since you just went through all the chip news.
Yeah. So, Alan, if you skipped ahead to this, you may want to go back. But bottom line is, we don't talk about this as much because it is becoming less relevant. If you have these devices, they're likely still going to work for a while. So don't like run out and burn them. And I would say even if you bought new Z-Wave devices today, you're probably going to buy it from a reputable manufacturer that is going to put a bridge out, you know, because we're going to see chip come out hopefully later this year. So we'll see a bridge or a controller that can handle your Z-Wave products.
If he's invested in smart things, which he says he is, and Samsung is a major player here in chip, I don't think he'll be left out in the cold.
Yes. Well, Samsung isn't producing its own hardware anymore. So Samsung's just offering the software on smart things. So
AOTech to the rescue.
AOTech is your man, or your company, rather. The other thing, so I would say in like 6 years, I don't know if we're going to see a lot of new Zigbee and Z-Wave stuff coming in the market. So Silicon Labs is testing with Z-Wave long-range line-of-sight transmission for up to a mile, which that's a lot. That's the far range. And so I think if you look at something like that, you might be able to see Z-Wave devices that are designed for the garden or outside the house. So we get tons of questions about like open-close sensors for shed doors or motion detection for a long driveway or a mailbox. I would be interested in like moisture sensors for my garden. So it's possible that Z-Wave will, I guess, find a new use case, a new niche, basically.
It could. I still worry, and we talked about this before the show, and you made some good points on why I shouldn't be worried, but I still worry about how LoRa might just come in and take that space.
Yeah, so LoRa to me feels like it's so much harder to build and to implement LoRa. That's true, actually.
It's true.
And, you know, Amazon is working with their own version of LoRa, which is their Sidewalk network. So long range is definitely an area that's relatively uncovered right now. So maybe Z-Wave, with its established base of developers and, you know, supporters, will compete with Amazon Sidewalk or LoRa. Who knows?
Yeah. He also asked about Zigbee, and I'll share my thoughts, which are arguable, and you can refute or approve of them. I have less concern about Zigbee because it's the Zigbee Alliance that is working or herding the cats for Project Chip. And the radio technology for Chip could support Zigbee. So I have less worry if you have Zigbee devices. It doesn't mean it's going to be part of Chip as Zigbee devices, but that's my thought.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is a fresh branding effort by the Zigbee Alliance to become more of whatever the Chip Alliance is. But we also, I guess I should have said this. We still don't know what Project Chip is going to actually be called for the rest of the world, forever else. It is not supposed to stay Project Chip, believe it or not. So, All right. Well, that's it. Thank you, Alan, for calling in. Remember, if you would like to call us, you can reach us at 512-623-7424. And that's about it for this week's show. Please stay tuned for our guest, Sarah Spangolo, the CEO of Swarm. We're going to be talking about satellite IoT connectivity. This is crazy pricing. Y'all are going to be really stoked about it. And we'll also hear from our sponsor, DigiCert. Hey everyone, we are taking a break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is DigiCert, which is a leading global provider of PKI and digital certificate management, which helps secure connected devices and users at internet scale. And I have Mike Nelson, who is the VP of IoT Security at DigiCert, here with us today. Hello, Mike. How are you doing?
Hey, Stacy. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So first off, why don't you just tell us, why is integrity such a big part of IoT security?
You're right. It certainly is. Integrity is critical when addressing IoT security. It represents trust. And so you need it for things like code integrity, for over-the-air updates or firmware updates, execution integrity, knowing that your devices are operating in a state of integrity, and finally, data integrity, knowing that any data your device is generating can be trusted.
Got it. So what happens when integrity goes wrong?
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of news examples of that recently. The SolarWinds attack is a great example of a lack of integrity. SolarWinds signed an update package that contained malware, and that malware was distributed to over 18,000 of their customers that downloaded it and then had malware on the servers that were leveraging that software.
That is a scary example and very relevant. So how does DigiCert help solve the lack of integrity?
Yeah, and working with many large organizations, I've seen some really bad practices around signing. And most of these aren't the signing itself, it's the processes around the signing. Lack of control, signing keys, not having rights management or reporting capabilities. Code signing usually isn't the problem, it's those processes that cause organizations challenges. DigiCert has a secure software manager built on our modern PKI DigiCert One platform that helps organizations establish scalable and controlled processes around signing events throughout their entire organization. Things like signing workflows that need to be automated are an important part of development process. Our signing manager provides secure storage and on-demand access to signing keys. Another important aspect of secure signing is rights management and knowing who has signed and what they've signed. Our platform provides comprehensive rights management, giving you full control over all of the signings. And finally, in addition to these great features, our platform provides full reporting and auditability of the entire system. So you can know from an organizational perspective and have visibility into all the signing events going on.
Sounds great. All right. Well, Mike, where can I go to learn more about DigiCert?
Your listeners can learn more about our Secure Signing Manager at digicert.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Sarah Spangolo, who is co-founder and CEO of Swarm. Hello, Sarah. How are you today?
Hello, thanks for having me. Doing well.
Excellent. All right. I am excited to do this because Swarm is a satellite IoT company, and we're going to be talking about bringing satellite connectivity to devices. But I have covered satellites since like 2005, and they have come so far from these like boondoggly bankrupt industries where private equity firms would like buy up spectrum and then promote these crazy plans, and it very rarely worked. Everybody just cycled in and out of bankruptcy. And what happened was this huge sea change in satellites. The availability of smaller satellites enabled, you know, cheaper launches. It enabled new startups to come into the space. And that's what Swarm's all about. So I'm really excited to have you on the show, and we're going to talk about this. So let's talk about the change in the economics of the satellite business. And I'm assuming that influenced your decision to start Swarm.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I started thinking about satellites probably even after you started covering them. So I was in grad school in like 2010. And around that time, CubeSats were starting to get a lot of attention. And CubeSats are this standard form factor that has emerged. It's about the size of a big shoebox, so 10 by 10 by about 34 centimeters. And when I was in grad school at Michigan, we actually had the privilege of flying one of the first science-funded CubeSat missions. And I remember there was a lot of questioning if CubeSats or small sats could do real science. And that was what our mission proved out. And at that time, that was super cool to think that something that we could hold in our hands could do useful science, right? And obviously, we've come a long ways from that in 10 years. And we've seen lots of science CubeSats be launched by universities, by JPL, where I later worked, and by government. And then we've also seen this emergence of small sat companies like Planet Labs and Spire that are doing imaging and AIS, super useful stuff from this super tiny platform. And yeah, that was totally part of the motivation for starting Swarm. And we wanted to take it one step further by shrinking the satellites another 10x if we could. And that's really what we set out to do. And we decided to focus on connectivity because you can actually do that on a very small form factor. So there are several trends that have been emerging over the past few years that make it a unique time to start Swarm. And those are a combination of the miniaturization of electronics that we see resulting in the amazing cell phone and laptop technology that we have today. In fact, your cell phone is far more capable and intelligent than most satellites in space today. That combined with this emergence of the CubeSat form factor, which is this great form factor that's been standardized that was pretty easy to launch given the availability of emerging launch companies.
Okay, you guys have 93 satellites in the air. That's pretty amazing. You're going to 156 before the end of this year. And people can get access, or rather business customers can get access to your network for $5 per device per month. And the cost of about $119 device that receives the signal from the satellites, y'all call it a swarm tile. So with that business model, what kind of customers are you seeing choose your network?
So we're seeing customers that are trying to connect devices in remote locations and typically are trying to send pretty small amounts of data either to the internet or back. Our network is two-way. And these span verticals across agriculture, logistics, maritime, energy, environmental monitoring, and lots of other random use cases that we hear about every day, like tracking birds and scooters and whales and beehives and really a long tail of other really interesting but kind of random use cases. We're typically dealing with customers that are frustrated with existing connectivity solutions. So maybe they've typically used Cell, but Cell actually only covers about 10% of the Earth's surface area, leaving 90% disconnected. And they're looking for different solutions to be able to connect. Probably haven't been able to afford traditional satellite solutions, so they're looking for a lower cost alternative like Swarm. And then we also have customers that are using satellite today, maybe one of the existing legacy players, but are very frustrated with the price point, the reseller model, the support, and some of the other challenges that those networks have. Keep in mind, they were willing to pay quite a lot for those legacy satellite solutions. So by switching to Swarm, they're able to generally significantly improve their margins, reduce their prices, and potentially open the new market. We kind of deal with both types of customers as we look to integrate Swarm.
And for customers who might be evaluating satellite connectivity, I think it's really important for them to understand what satellites can and can't do because, you know, you're talking to space. There might be latency issues. There may not be full coverage. This is not good for video, for example. So what are some of the trade-offs associated with using a satellite connection?
Yeah, definitely. So satellites are obviously very far from the Earth. They typically orbit, or at least ours orbit, around 500 kilometers. So it's pretty far away. That means, you know, there's some major kind of link challenges in closing the link. So trade-offs for our satellites, at least, is that we transfer relatively low amounts of data. So this is not doing your Zoom or Netflix or anything like that. It's transferring small, kind of like tweet-sized messages. And our plan is such that people can move on average about one message an hour, which is more than enough for most of our use cases because they're remote devices just trying to move small amounts of data. We theoretically can move a lot more than that off of a single device, but we decide to limit it just so that we can support a large number of devices around the world. And then we're focusing on communications. So we're not doing imaging or AIS or any of the other interesting things that you can do with satellites. We're just moving these kind of bite-sized packets of data around the world.
Got it. And I can tell you, even in my home, and I am not your commercial customer base, obviously, but I have a huge need for a sensor that just reports back every few hours. Like I'm thinking about the sensors in my garden that I've got. I'm like, So I can totally see how this would be valuable for people. Another slightly unique thing about your network is that you're not transmitting to a gateway. You're transmitting directly to the device itself. And I know that there are several competitors of yours out there that are doing like satellite to LoRa or satellite to NB-IoT. And I'm curious why you chose to do that, I guess, satellite to Swarm Tile.
Yeah, definitely. So we've talked to probably 1,000 customers at this point from early days of starting Swarm over 4 years ago across all of the industries that I mentioned. And we found that most customers are actually looking for a device that can go one-to-one with their asset or moisture sensor or whatever they're trying to connect to the internet. And the reason for that is sometimes these devices are mobile, so it might be a buoy or a truck or a train or a container ship that's being shipped across the ocean. So they don't want to rely on any sort of aggregation model just because of the dynamics and geography that may not be close to an aggregator or a gateway all of the time. So they prefer the one-to-one model. There are some use cases where people want to do the aggregation. If they have a bunch of agricultural sensors, for example, in a relatively close proximity, then what they can do is aggregate to a single device and then send to space. So we actually do support people doing that. And we have some people developing LoRaWAN gateways so that people can do LoRaWAN on the ground and then backhaul through satellite. So we have, I would say, more of a flexible architecture, but we realize that most of our customers want to go one-to-one. And then also our pricing is so low that it's not prohibitively expensive to go one-to-one.
That makes sense. And also, I guess if you're looking at the bandwidth constraints, there if you're going too many in trying to aggregate it at the gateway, it might kind of overwhelm it.
Totally. Yep.
There are a lot of satellite companies out there. Like this is a big market, and there's a bunch of subtleties in how each of them might be approaching the market. But Do you think there are too many? I mean, it's very confusing for someone who might be trying to evaluate connectivity, but I think it's also, there's just a lot of money in satellites. And historically, that tends to lead to problems later down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'm the right person to comment on that because I am one of those companies and trying to survive in this ecosystem. But I do think there are a lot of satellite companies. I would always encourage customers to look at how real a company is. And I think a measure of realness is how many satellites you have. It's a pretty easy calculation. So, you know, you look at Starlink, hundreds, almost thousands of satellites. Swarm, dozens of satellites, almost 100 satellites. You know, we offer a real service right now. We're commercially live. We're working with commercial customers around the world. So I think that it's really important to look at that. And then, you know, the long-term feasibility of the company. And that often comes down to the capital raised, the capital required, the team, and if they can execute. And I think, you know, like a lot of things, there's also a lot of app companies and there's a lot of security companies and a lot of SaaS companies. There typically is kind of a shakeout of who the winners will be. And that typically becomes evident over a few years. And I think we're going to probably see that in the satellite space as well.
Agreed. So how long do your satellites last in orbit?
Yeah, they last about 4 years. So they're always experiencing a little bit of drag, even at their super high altitudes, around 500 kilometers. So they're always slowly deorbiting, which is kind of funny, experiencing drag just like you experience drag in a plane. And then once they hit a certain altitude, they actually just burn up. Everything disintegrates, so nothing comes back down to Earth. We like to call it a self-cleaning orbit. And then, you know, we're constantly launching our next generation satellites to replenish those old satellites.
Are there limits to the number of customers you can win in any geographic area?
Yeah. So, you know, there's certainly capacity constraints on any network, capacity being the amount of data you can move over a region. And that's something that we're very familiar with. I think, you know, we can very likely support millions of devices. So we have a ways to go, lots of customers to onboard before we hit any of those constraints. And we try to do really smart things on the networking and limiting the amount of data that every single device can send so that we can get a lot of users on that network. But of course, we will eventually hit a capacity constraint, like any network, really. Any even cell or Wi-Fi or Bluetooth network has capacity limitations. And, you know, we've already started thinking about what we do next to try to solve for some of those capacity limitations. And we have some really cool ideas. Unfortunately, I can't share them. They're too secretive, but I think you're going to see some exciting stuff come from Swarm over the next few years.
Okay. Well, let's just paint a picture for me of the future. So 4 or 5 years from now, let's say we now have really good and cheap satellite coverage for our sensors. What does that enable for us?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the future is really exciting. I think there's some pretty obvious things like being able to track people, regardless of where they are on the planet. So no one ever getting lost again would be a pretty cool outcome from Swarm. And then also a lot of assets get lost, whether it's a shipping container or a bird scooter or, you know, some sort of truck or container. So being able to track devices all around the world will be useful. There's also some really cool things that can be done with fire detection and weather monitoring. So if we had sensor networks that better detected whether or not there was smoke and fire throughout California, for example, and Australia and all places in the world that experience fires, we could better hone in on where they start and hopefully, you know, shut them down and be able to send crews earlier to those locations. And that could have a significant impact on the environment, but also, you know, health implications. We had horrible fires here in California last summer for weeks and weeks, and it was really, really devastating. And then weather sensors. So if we're able to better predict weather patterns, then we can be more intelligent about determining flight paths and shipping paths. And that can help us significantly reduce CO2 emissions. So making the entire logistics and supply chains more efficient, which obviously has a huge impact on climate. And then there's a lot of other things that you can do with sensing across agriculture. So knowing, you know, what the water levels are, whether or not a crop needs to be watered or whether or not it's, you know, ready to be harvested. And then a lot of applications across energy. So having a better awareness of how electricity metering is going, what's going on with oil and gas, what's going on with solar panels and windmills all around the world. And that's just kind of tip of the iceberg. I think there's probably hundreds of applications that we haven't even dreamed up yet where we could use SWARM. But I'm really excited about kind of the health, safety, and then climate change impacts that we can kind of indirectly support with this low-cost satellite infrastructure.
So some of these things that you've mentioned are both, they're real-time. They would benefit from having real-time connectivity. So something like more GPS orientation, or maybe even like a LoRa or a constant stream of data. And some of them would also benefit from having the satellite connectivity. So I'm wondering if you see devices coming at, like, maybe it's a Bird scooter that has a satellite radio for like super backup if it gets lost, and maybe a normal LTE Cat M radio for the rest of the time.
Yeah, so we definitely do see use cases where people want that kind of hybrid approach. So satellite when you're outside of cell and cell when you're in cell, and that allows you to move larger amounts of data for low cost in cell and then have this nice backup network with SWARM. So we definitely see that. We also see some people deciding to totally just scrap the cell and switch to satellite because they want one continuous carrier over the entire globe. And you can imagine a company like Ford, who we're partnering with, they have to go and cut cell phone deals with every European country. Like, imagine the headache that that is. And if they could work with SWARM and only have a single carrier for global coverage, that's very attractive and might be more economical for that type of application. So I guess we would see both. And I think that as we're, you know, as we're able to move to future generations and potentially lower pricing even more, I think we're going to see more of a trend towards satellite.
Got it. All right. Well, congratulations, Sarah, and thank you so much for coming on the show this week.
Thank you. This was fun. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week.